Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whoever else we can find who's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel. Joining us this week is Brian C. Lee Jr. and Sue Mobley of Colocate, a New Orleans-based nonprofit design justice practice which organizes, advocates, and designs spaces of racial, social, and cultural equity. As you'll hear in the interview, their ethos is rooted in the belief that systems of power, whether they be corrupt or benign, inform the prevailing political and economic systems acting on a community, and those systems in turn begin to create the built environment. Designers, therefore, live at a nexus and have a responsibility to be aware of how they can become instruments of power or instruments of agency. They can be complicit systems of oppression, or they can fight against them. Colocate is a relatively new organization, but both Brian and Sue have been active in social justice for many years. I wanted to get them on the show because I think that a certain seismic political shifts have rattled our world and left much of the design community in a vague stupor. Colocate has already taken those shifts and turned them into direct action. They're leveraging the chaos that we're all living through and using it to speak to issues that have been festering for decades, even centuries. Here on this show, we're only beginning to talk about what design looks like in an era of resistance. But Brian and Sue have been at top speed the entire time. But they tell the story a lot better than I do, so let's go straight to the interview. Brian, Sue, thank you both so much for joining the show. I think your voices are very important ones to be adding to this segment. And with all that's happened in the last year and a half, I've been really excited to talk to you guys. And I know our listeners are going to enjoy getting to know you and hear your story as well. So with that, I'm wondering if we could frame it up a little bit. Sue, your background is in political science, anthropology, and sociology. Do I have that right?
Yep.
And Brian, you're an architect. How did the two of you originally come together to form Colocate?
Sue and I have been in the same area of expertise for a little while now. Specifically, I have been working on a few projects that were program-centric, that were really specifically thinking about the ways in which social justice had implications on the way our youth have agency over their built environment, the way our communities have access to design skill sets. And oftentimes those projects connected with Sue's work over the last 5 years. And so we've gotten to know each other over that time and figure out that we have some complementary assets that we can kind of bring together in this work. And so ultimately we thought that might be a good way for us to kind of move something along that was different than the way in which other practices work.
I've been working over the past few years at the small center at Tulane School of Architecture, trying to get architecture students to think about people and policy and social justice as things that should be considerations in design. I think Brian and I mostly ended up either in the same rooms around organizing or on panels together, probably 50 times over the last 3 years. And at some point you realize that the person who is going to finish your sentence or give the rest of the argument for you on a panel, it's probably someone you should be working with more.
Right. Yeah. Was there an initial instigator for the creation of Colocate? You guys have this kind of rich working history together. Tell me about the day where you said, hey, we should start doing this.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I worked at SQ Dumas Ripple here in New Orleans for a little while, 2014. I left and went and worked at the Arts Council of New Orleans. Going from standard practice at a really high level to a nonprofit organization with the Arts Council was a dramatic shift for me, and it was a really positive shift for me, but it was also something that I was lacking the day-in, day-out design that I needed to kind of feel fulfilled in a lot of ways. And so when I left that job, I decided, okay, well, I can go ahead and go back to another firm, or I can give this a shot and figure out how to make a design justice practice work in New Orleans. What I went about doing was just hanging out at the small center every day for months on end until Sue decided that she should just join the practice. So yeah, I just kind of hung around her until she said yes.
That sounds terrible.
Well, relative to me, yeah, it does sound terrible. Sorry, I hung around the small center asking her to willfully join Colocate.
and steadily saying, hey, this project just came up. Do you want to be part of this project?
Yes.
Hey, what about this project? You want to be part of this project? It turns out I want to be part of all the projects.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. So for the uninitiated, what is design justice?
Yeah. So design justice is there's a skill set that's been crafted and worked on throughout the design profession that's usually thrown off to the side by the larger profession. But it's really around understanding the privilege and power structures that use architecture and design as a means to perpetuate injustice throughout the built environment, and the ways in which you can use design as a means to respond to those injustices, but also to re-stratify the profession in a way that allows for communities to have more consistent, more perpetual, more leveraged access to the design process overall, and to consider the pedagogy, policies, procedures, practices, and the people that are that make up the entirety of the design process, not simply just individual projects one at a time.
And it's an opportunity to be really deliberate about what it means to include people, not as a box that you're checking or as respondents to an already conceived design, but to really be able to take the time and spend the energy bringing people along with you through a process, and being responsive to what their needs are and what their desires are and what those legacies of injustice have been in people's lived experience of their built environment, so that we're not just filling a hole in a current design practice, but bringing back in the narratives of injustice, bringing back in the understandings of space that are so much a part of our communities that people don't necessarily have the technical language to contribute to a discussion when it is purely around design, but certainly have the knowledge and the capacity to represent that understanding if given tools and given space and being heard as real stakeholders in their own communities.
And is that the basis of your pedagogy, Sue? I mean, how do you teach that to students?
Carefully. That's absolutely the basis of my pedagogy, and it's the basis of my understanding of the role of pedagogy, is that it should be radical, that it should be open-ended, and that it's constantly a function of praxis, that we are learning, acting, reflecting, and that we're doing that as part of communities, that we are not, as students, as teachers, as practitioners, absent from or abstracted from the communities within which we work. So my students do an unusual amount of reading for architecture students, and learn basic design ethnography tools. They spend a lot of time doing interviews and surveys and looking at what people's reactions are very early in the process to things that are already in place before they have the space to think about what their interventions might be.
Why is that novel? I mean, what you just said makes so much sense to me. It just seems like an intrinsic part of any design process that you would, you know, get to know your client and their situation before you sat down and designed something for them. And it seems that in today's day and age, we have to be deliberate about reminding students that that's part of the process. Why is that?
Partly because we have a strange way of defining client versus user, neighborhood versus community. Our definitions are abstracted in ways that actually don't mean anything. And so when you say client, or when client is brought up, 99% of the time in this country, that is a developer or a city, right? And so client is different than the person who's going to use this space day in, day out on a consistent basis for their means to survive. A completely different way in which you approach design when you consider those two separate things. When neighborhood is brought up versus community, neighborhood is a geographic or a regional kind of understanding of the space itself. But communities can exist ephemerally, they can exist perpetually, but they can also exist outside the bounds of the geographic space. And so when you understand actually who the users are, which being in communities, it can't be abstract, it is specific. And then you understand the community, you can actually do better work. And right now we just have poor definitions in a lot of ways.
I'm actually going to say that that's really about power.
Yeah.
That when we talk about who the client is, when we talk about who gets to make decisions, what we're really talking about is who has power and who has access to capital. At best, in a standard design practice, at best in, you know, late stage capitalism, we're talking about who has the right to call the shots on the basis of who controls the dollars or who controls the geography. And I have, you know, a real problem with that as a human. I have a real problem with that as someone who's part of a design practice, as someone who's a citizen of a city where the people who live here, the majority, don't have power, don't have that kind of ability to control the environment in which they live. But I also have a problem with the idea of conceptualizing the community, because there isn't a the community.
Yeah.
And when we use those terms, we're often using them to create an imagined community that is disenfranchised, that is disengaged, that doesn't have power. And it's often a nod to sort of that representation as being one abstract and singular entity that may or may not be considered a stakeholder, but certainly isn't engaged with as a variety of people who have different stances and differentiated stances to the environment in which they live. My neighborhood is made up of 380 households who represent different ages and income levels and racial and ethnic backgrounds, all of whom are part of my community, but not all of whom have the same stance or the same understanding or the same needs out of their built environment.
But it seems like, you know, in our current conception of the built environment, those 380 households, the vast majority, or maybe even all of them, are excluded from the decisions that really impact how their space is built and how they live.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I would even go further. I mean, like, most cities have a poor way in which they do neighborhood planning processes. And so a lot of communities and neighborhoods are excluded from that process because of the way in which the system has been set up. There are fundamental flaws in the ways in which systems work that expect you to have input directly at the acute moment where a project or an action is being placed on it, whether that's a development, whether that's a variance change in a community, and the like. And so until we understand where that process is continually flawed and then rectify that, we're going to continue to output things that are not useful to, again, the end user, the people who will functionally need that space to be accessible.
You're listening to Social Design Insights. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from Brian C. Lee Jr. and Sue Mobley of Co-Locate about design justice, what it is, and how to teach it. But we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to be talking about Co-Locate's groundbreaking project, Paper Monuments, and the unbelievable story that gave rise to it. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights. We've been speaking with Brian C. Lee Jr. and Sue Mobley of Co-Locate about design justice. And coming up, we're going to talk in more specifics about how to turn ethics into action. Let's jump in. A lot of our audience is young designers, and they're continually facing questions surrounding what you two have both spoken about is, you know, the sort of positioning of the designer in the city, right? And, you know, architecture, at least, is a market-based profession, you know, like it has to go where those dollars are. And I think sometimes there's an illusionary binary choice that young designers face between going to work for the market, in which case you work at a big firm and you work for developers, you design hotels or whatever it is, or, you know, living this life of entrenched poverty and, you know, sleeping on your buddy's couch while you do human interest work. How would you two deconstruct that myth? What would you say to a young designer who is saying to you, hey, you know, I really want to do good in my community, but I've got bills to pay, so I've got to go work over here?
you're going to be fighting regardless. It's hard to work in a professional practice, whether it's Gensler, whether it's EDR, whether it's Co-Locate, right? Like, the professional practice is a hard thing to do. So the first thing I would say is, if you have a purpose, find that purpose and allow that to drive the projects that you're seeking in the practice that you're looking at, regardless of whether or not it's a large firm or a small firm. You can be an entrepreneur and you can be an entrepreneur. You can work within practices to change the way models work. It doesn't mean that it's going to be the most successful thing all the time, but oftentimes if you believe in a thing, it is not a binary choice. It means that you carry that with you wherever you are. And so if you believe in it, take it to Gensler and take it to, you know, the Smith Group, take it to wherever and bring those values, instill those values into the work that you're producing at those places. Ultimately, more practices like ours want to be in the world and we will fight to help that happen. But if you don't find that, then take your purpose with you wherever you go.
And take that purpose with you, not just into your firm, but into your life and into your community and into your neighborhood. Be the person at the neighborhood meeting who can create a plan for an alternative, or who can sketch the idea that people are trying to talk through. Be the person who shows up at city council with the 2-foot by 3-foot drawing of why this is a bad idea. Yeah. Use your skill sets where they do good and where they often aren't brought into play. I do a lot of organizing with a lot of different groups, and often the ideas are there, but the ability to convey them is more of a challenge, or the ability to use a process to get everybody on the same page. And that's a skill set that designers have and that can produce incredible results, like game-changing results for organizations, if they're brought to bear with humility and respect and a willingness to listen, with very little effort put forth, you know, with very little time committed. The difference between being able to understand something because everyone has looked at the same piece of paper and seen it, as opposed to 4 hours of people talking through what they think it is, genuinely does change the playing field on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah, it moves conversations that are usually stagnant along, whether for good or for bad. You have the conversation in a lot of ways that would not happen without the visual, without the kind of schematic to respond to.
So the designer can position themselves as a sort of visual interpreter of a community or a group's intent and move the conversation along that way.
You're a translator. Yeah, you can act as a translator in a lot of ways. Language is such a powerful thing. The way in which Spanish and English use very similar phonemes, right? But you can see the same thing in the architecture of Latin America versus America. Like, you can see that the language of architecture is similar in other places, but it means entirely different things to people. And so understanding those small little nuances allows you to be a translator of place and space in the same way that somebody might be an interpreter in other ways.
Let's draw that out. I wanted to talk about paper monuments and introduce our audience to that idea, because I think a lot of it is related to this idea of language. You know, our built space is a language unto itself that says things and means things. Certain things are objectively racist or objectively spiteful, and there are elements in our built environment that they say that. There are other elements in our built environment that are objectively hopeful and encouraging, an encouraging space. How did you two come up with paper monuments, and what was the instigator?
Over the process of the monuments being taken down, we were both involved loosely with Take 'Em Down NOLA, and we're out at all of the meetings and marches and rallies, and then at all the takedowns. And when the statue of Beauregard was being removed from City Park, it was quite a large and awkward statue, and it was a really long process. I think we were out there for about 7 hours. And we were lucky to be out there for 7 hours with a bunch of artists and designers and activists and academics. And, you know, you have 7 hours. You have a lot of time to talk and think. And we spent that time thinking about what's next and starting a conversation there that continued over the next few days at the takedown at the Lee Monument, and then at the next week at a conference called Design Futures, where we spent 5 days with great students and great practitioners and great scholars, all of whom were deeply interested in the overall conversation around Confederate monuments and what had happened in New Orleans, all of whom loved New Orleans. And we had the opportunity to brainstorm with some awesome people for a prolonged period of time about what was next and how we got there. The core of our paper monuments team assembled itself in that moment.
Yeah, I always tell this story about, you know, coming up to that Beauregard, because I actually was a little bit behind that evening, and I was riding up to the Beauregard takedown. I had been thinking the whole time how at each takedown, this Beauregard was the third one to come down. At each takedown, the kind of spitefulness of the, how do you call it? The
angry flag waving,
right side of history,
wrong side of history.
Those who are on the wrong side of history were really spiteful and angry. And like the first one, they were carrying their guns around and yelling. But you could see their hope draining every single one of these that were coming down. Now, mind you, these are the same people who would eventually go on to be in Charlottesville and to be kind of across the country at all these other takedowns that were succeeded by the takedowns that happened here in New Orleans. So anyway, I was thinking, okay, well, we should do something funny, maybe have like a bunch of little violins that we, you know, kind of all are playing in some instance and just share those for the final takedown.
Wait, did you actually do that?
Well, here's the thing. So I get there and I'm like, Sue, got this great idea. How about we have a bunch of tiny violins because pity party, right? And Sue's like, fantastic. Let me find all the data for that. So she goes in within 5 minutes.
Hold on a second, guys. They're carrying around machine guns and you're proposing to bring tiny violins?
Indeed.
Yeah, okay.
Indeed.
All right, awesome.
The right side of history was having a party throughout. Like our side kept getting bigger.
Yeah.
The food kept getting better. People were bringing, you know, increasing amounts of alcohol to share. Bringing their kids out, bringing their dogs out.
Yeah.
We were having a party. We had a brass band.
Yeah, and we're radical, and like people are intelligent and very smart, but we're also a little bit petty. And so I think
we're a lot petty.
We're a lot petty. And so I think having the tiny violins was really just an ode to how petty one can be in these types of situations, which is particularly, I think, hilarious to us. Anyway, the point was is that, you know, Sue organized and tried to find 500 of these tiny violins. She found the pricing and organized at least, 10 people, 15 people to go ahead and put money on this. Within like 30 minutes, we had this kind of organized thing that was about to go down. So anyway, we looked at that and said, you know what? We can do this, but maybe we focus our efforts on something that may have a longer impact. And so Paper Monuments was then seeded and generated over the next month or so.
And for our listeners, like what is it? We'll provide some links to it on the website, but describe the project for us.
It's a multi-stage project, in part because we're always figuring out where the next amount of time comes from, where the next range of funding comes from, what the city's going to let us get away with, how hard we can push those boundaries. And stage one was reaching out to scholars and activists and thinkers around New Orleans history and New Orleans stories to collect the short form essays of what people, places, movements, and events they felt were missing from New Orleans' narrative about itself. And to pair those stories with curated art from local artists that spoke to the narratives and could be presented in the world as a series of posters that are both available for pickup and for people to take home, but are also then turned into installations across the city that promote a set of narratives that are not part of New Orleans' sort of tourism-driven cycle of this is who we are, this often romanticized vision of both antebellum life and of a New Orleans free of conflict that is so much a part of our story, so much part of how we draw 10 million visitors a year and create a third of our economy. Paired with that, we've worked closely with Monuments Lab out of Philadelphia, who've spent several years doing their own collection of community suggestions of what monuments should be in public spaces. And we're doing a similar or a related form of outreach here to be at community meetings, to be at second lines, to be at public places, collecting suggestions from everyday folks about what they think should be honored in public space and where that should go and why it matters.
Yeah, I mean, it is fundamentally a public history and public art project that kind of speaks to the ways in which history is embedded with us at all points in time, whether that's in our, again, the people, the places, events, and movements that have shaped the city. And that's not just our city. Sue often talks about New Orleans has this tendency to feel as though we are exceptional from the larger narrative of what America's history is. And it is not. You know, we are within the frame. And oftentimes, we are the leading edge of some of the injustices that define how America has progressed. And so this is a way for us to not only bring to light some of the pushback to those injustices, but the people who spearheaded and the movements that spearheaded some of these larger conversations that are happening. I mean, we were in the midst of something here that is beautiful in the sense that, you know, somebody got together with a group and said, let's reignite a conversation around taking down monuments. That is a 30-year conversation on top of another 30-year conversation. And it's been 70 total years asking for this city to respect the decency of its majority population. And without fail, it was ignored. And so for that fight to be picked back up, and then for that fight to be transferred to Memphis, to Dallas, to Richmond, to Charlottesville, and to see it happen across the waters, like, these things are super powerful, and we are not exceptional in a lot of ways. We are exceptional in a lot of ways, but we are not exceptional from the larger narrative of what it means to be American. And so we hope that this is a way for us to kind of further that conversation moving forward.
And is paper monuments national? Is that being picked up in other cities?
Not yet.
Not yet. So good answer.
Kind of amazing if it were.
Yeah. Well, we'll try and get the word out. I think it's a beautiful program, and it struck me as there's a sort of exclusiveness and autocracy involved in our public monuments, which are the defining characteristics of our public space. And public space has got to be for everybody, or it's for nobody. So I was just super excited when I read about this approach, a fundamentally democratic approach to how do we define public space and the monuments within it. You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. I'd like to thank my guests of the week, Brian C. Lee Jr. and Sue Mobley of Co-Locate Design, for helping us ignite this conversation about design justice and how to practice it. They'll be back next week to expand on some of these issues and give us a temperature check on the professions of design, how much progress has been made, and what the future holds. We hope that you'll tune into that. To learn more about Co-Locate Design, please visit us at our website at www.socialdesigninsights.com. There you'll find links to their most current projects and some guides to further your research. If you have any feedback on the show, ideas for guests, or just want to chat, you can write to me, eric@socialdesigninsights.com. That's eric@socialdesigninsights.com. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation. If you haven't already, please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Curry Stone Foundation. That's Curry Stone FDN. On all three platforms for all the latest news on social impact design.